Welcome to Worldview from WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonald. The climate crisis is beginning to force a discussion about what's important in our lives, what we can do without, and how we can change to benefit everyone. Colin Bevan knows a few things about giving things up. He's best known for his book and movie No Impact Man, where he and his family lived for a year with minimal impact in New York. The book and movie are still popular 10 years on. And Colin Bevan knows a few things about what benefits people. His subsequent book was called How to Be Alive, A Guide to the Happiness That Helps the World, and it's about living lives in accordance with our values. Thanks a lot for joining us, Colin Bevan.
Hi, Jerome. It's nice to be with you.
I wonder if you could take us on a little bit of a journey about what you learned from No Impact Man 10 years ago, and you moved forward with this different kind of project, which seems to be an extension of that in a way, about being happy in the world and trying to find your people. How did you get from one to the other?
Sure. So No Impact Man was a book about me and my family living as environmentally as possible here in New York City. And it came because I had already published two history books, but I was very worried about the wars for oil, what happens when we burn fossil fuels to our climate, and the fact that people didn't seem, for all that burning of fossil fuels and destroying our climate, that people didn't seem as happy as they might be. So there's this question about our way of life. And so I lived with my family as environmentally as possible, which doesn't mean that we didn't recycle more. It was much more radical. We didn't do anything that made trash. We didn't eat food that came from more than 100 miles away. We didn't transport ourselves in any way that caused fossil fuel emissions. excuse me. And what we found out was that some of the things, for example, we got rid of our television. And some of the things that we did actually made for a happier life for us, because when we got rid of our television, we had a big hole in our daily routine, and we filled that with friends and community, and actually found that that made for happiness. And so one of the big discoveries of the No Impact Man experiment was that when we live in line with our values and when we live in line with what our planet needs from us as humanity, actually there's a good chance that we can become happier if we kind of put down the whole consumption, consumer economy mindset. And after that book came out, it very much exploded in the press, and I was asked to travel around and speak around the world, and everybody kept asking, what can I do? What can I do? But what can I do in terms of helping the world is context sensitive. There's no way that somebody else can give you directions. Plus, I also believe that part of our problem is that we're all following directions instead of referring to our values inside. So How to Be Alive was kind of this answer to this question. What can I do? You know, you're No Impact Man, but what can I do? So the question becomes like, who are you and what kind of a person are you and what do you care about and how can we find a way where you can address your life to things that you care about while also having a prosperous, abundant, joyful life?
You do some attacks on what you call the standard life approaches, and you make a pretty good case that, well, if you don't feel some level of alienation by the standard life approaches and the things that expectations that everyone has, you're probably, you know, not feeling things. You're not doing it right.
Well, I wouldn't actually want to criticize people who are finding that the standard life approach works for them. If it works for them, it works for them. But basically, we have this kind of societal myth. And the myth is you go to school and you work hard so that you can get into a good college, and then you take out college loans and you graduate from college, and maybe you do a master's, maybe, you know, even further your education, and you get a job and you put away money for retirement and you find a romantic partner and have some kids and get a mortgage. And when you're 60 or 65 or so, all of that comes to fruition because you get to retire and hopefully go on some cruises or something like that. And meanwhile, you get to have the feeling that you've actually been contributing to society by paying your taxes, which fund our social services and our fire and our police and our government and all that. So you've been contributing in that way, and you've been contributing by keeping the wheels of the economy going too, by both working and spending. That's the kind of myth that we have. The problem is that, first of all, the promise of retirement is a pipe dream for many people now, so that doesn't come. And even the promise of a good job once you go to college, or the ability to even pay back your student loans is a pipe dream for some people. So, in other words, the old mythology is falling apart. And even if you do manage to make it work, oftentimes you make it work while feeling you're doing it at the expense of the planet and the rest of humanity, because we don't get to feel as though buying things and working hard and keeping the wheels of the economy moving is doing good, because what we see is race injustice, income inequality, planetary climate change. And so contributing to the status quo, a lot of us feel a certain unease with that now.
And it seems like plenty of young people, I mean, Greta Thunberg is talking about change coming, and so many young people are dissatisfied with the approach that you're dissatisfied with there. They seem to be looking for something different.
Sure. And because young people are facing the failure of the myth more than any of us, they're the ones that are reading the news about getting totally swamped by student debt. They're the ones that are hearing about climate change. And also they're the ones that are getting taught. Like, this is the generation where for the first time these things are being talked about in school. And the sad thing I'd say about Greta is Greta's obviously a hero. But the sad thing I think is that when we lionize her, what we do is we disown the hero inside us. You know, Greta's our savior. When in fact, you know, a lot of what How to Be Alive is about is finding the hero or savior within yourself. Like, how do we actually accept that we're empowered to change the world that we live in too? Not just Greta, but us too. Like, we're her fellow travelers.
Well, you talk about some of the stories that we tell ourselves that keep us from acting on our convictions and what we believe. Things like all people are selfish. There's a kind of an unbeatable government or corporation or capitalism or something that is stopping us. We're stuck in a system. Can you say something about the bad stories we tell ourselves that keep us from locating ourselves?
Yeah, so we what happens is we see the suffering in the world, and sometimes we feel as though it's overwhelming and there's nothing we can do about it. And so what we do is, instead of staying in the tension of I see suffering, I feel as though I might have some responsibility, psychologically, and this is perfectly natural, we begin to construct stories about why we can't help, why we can't either help the world and the communities that we care about, and why we can't help ourselves, why we can't move away from these sociological myths. And sometimes the story in particular that I like to talk about is the two stories surrounding hope. Sometimes people say, is there hope for the world? Can we fix these problems? I don't particularly like that question. I mean, I don't blame anybody for saying it, but the search for the answer feels irrelevant to me, because what really happens when we say, is there hope, is we could say, no, there's no hope. So then we tell ourselves a story. There's no hope. There's no point me doing anything. I don't have to shake my life up, and I'll just stay as I am. Or somebody says, there is hope. Oh, well, there's hope. So it's a fait accompli. You know, things will change for the better. So I just get to stay as I am. Now, that can sound moralistic and, you know, kind of austerely ethical. But the thing about it is that when we tell ourselves these stories that take away our own agency, they actually reduce our happiness and our life satisfaction. I mean, all of us have this experience of when we tell ourselves we're not capable of doing something, it doesn't give us a good feeling. It gives us a dissatisfied feeling. So being in this place of using stories that to disempower ourselves both harms the world, because we're not out there trying to bring about the world that we envision, and harms ourselves because we're pretending we're less than we are.
I'm talking with Colin Bevin. He's the author of How to Be Alive, A Guide to the Kind of Happiness That Helps the World. People have a hard time changing because they feel kind of strapped into their responsibilities, and they need to get health insurance, they need to pay the mortgage, they need to do all the things. How do you've got something called the ukulele approach to change, which is aimed at, you know, baby stepping the change in a way. How do you suggest people get started?
Right. So a lot of times what happens is we're like, I need to change my life. I need to change my career. I need to change where I live. We kind of imagine that we have to change these really big things to start. And it's scary to start with those really big things, not least of all because we don't know whether when we get to the other side of the big change, whether we'll be happy. We haven't tested out the hypothesis that we'll be happy in this new place. So the what I call the ukulele approach comes from a story in my own life about how forever I wanted to play guitar. I wanted to be able to play some music in my living room and sing along. But it just felt like too big a thing. And there's so many people out there that play the guitar so well. And how could, you know, what was the point of me playing guitar? But what I found was I would walk around. I live in Brooklyn in New York, and I'd walk around the parks and people would be out with their ukuleles, like strumming ukuleles. And actually a friend had a ukulele and she taught me like four chords. And suddenly I was strumming a ukulele and singing, and I bought myself a ukulele and learned to play the ukulele from YouTube videos. And the point here is that instead of setting up this gigantic, you know, I must learn to play guitar and I must learn to play it very well, I found this instrument called the, you know, the ukulele, which is incredibly forgiving, and suddenly I was going along. So excuse me, similarly with our life change, like we can say, I want to live more in line with my values. And there's a story in How to Be Alive about a woman called Anne, and she wants to live in line with her values, and she starts by just going to the grocery store and buying fair trade coffee. And she thinks to herself, that doesn't count for anything. It doesn't matter. But then she finds a fair trade coffee roaster, and she starts going there, and she becomes friends with the people who work there. And then they bring her along to a community garden. She starts volunteering at the community garden, and they go to a climate march, and she goes with them. And they find they're all in jobs that she wishes she has. And ultimately, she starts to make connections and find a job in social justice, and she actually is able to change her job. So the point is that we start by looking for small actions we can take, finding communities that share our values, and letting those small actions unfold instead of telling ourselves, you know, these small things don't count.
So one of your pieces of advice is give less energy to what is not true to you, and just try to ease into that.
Yeah, the full thing is give less energy to what is not true for you. Give more energy to what is true for you. And, you know, what intrigues me about that, I worded it out that way very carefully, but really that thing, do less bad, do more good. You know, so bad, again, I try to avoid the kind of moralistic approach of good and bad, but instead talk about true, what feels, if we refer inwards to ourselves and sit with our bodies and ask ourselves, does it feel true for us? Does it feel right for us? So if it doesn't, change it. If it does, don't change it. Like it's not up to me to tell you what's good and bad. It's up to you and your body, actually. So that's why I put it that way. What feels true for you? And can you give a little bit less energy for what doesn't feel true for you and a little more energy to what does? And this is actually the basis of all the great world religious traditions. Just do less bad, do more good. So again, it's not an attempt to become to force people into religion in any way, but it is to say that there is some wisdom that's been existing for a very long time that suggests that the basis of life is as simple as that. Do a little bit less of what's not true for you. Do a little bit more of what is true for you.
I think people feel stuck in a more static situation, though, a lot of the times. Like they've got to gut it out where they are, and they don't have room to give.
Yeah, I mean that is a story that we all tell ourselves, including me, that there's for some reason we can't do anything else, and that's why, coming back to what we talked about a minute ago, this ukulele approach, this starting from where you are. So in How to Be Alive, a basic underpinning philosophically of the whole thing is nonviolence and to not do violence against the world, And that includes not doing violence against ourselves. So there's this, for example, sometimes I would be out speaking and people would ask me questions. And I remember one time I was standing on a stage and a person raised her hand and she said, I'm a third grade teacher. She said, how do I teach my kids how to recycle? And I was like, well, didn't you just say you're a third grade teacher? And you know, everybody laughed. And I said, why would you ask me how to teach kids to recycle? It sounds like you have the expertise. And it also sounds like that's a place where you can start. So we can't all, you know, we may not be able to do big things, all of us. We may not. We might have to start small. But the trick is, it's okay to start small, but the trick is then not to let the question stop. So the question that I talk about is, how can I help? This it's almost a vow. It's almost a vow that we all have inside ourselves already. And when it gets frustrated, it makes us feel bad. So how can I help? And that we can hold this vow at all times. How can I help? And we'll see it. We can see it on the subway. Somebody needs our help getting up the stairs. We can see it in the office. You know, the people aren't recycling, so we set up a recycling system. We can see it in our city. We can see it in our climate change when we just decide that we're going to dedicate one Saturday afternoon to go out on a march. But it's not important that we all march. It's important that we all find our own ways of helping, this intersection between who we are and what the world needs.
I'm talking with Colin Bevin about some of the ideas in his book, How to Be Alive. Coming up after the break, we'll discuss the importance of finding your people. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and you're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and I'm talking with Colin Bevin. He's best known for his book, No Impact Man, and we're talking about some of the ideas in his subsequent book, How to Be Alive, A Guide to the Kind of Happiness That Helps the World. You've got a section in the book there where called Finding Your People, and it's interesting because it's so science-y that there is so much science data about how much our happiness is connected to communities and people that I didn't realize was there. Talk to me about that for a second.
Yeah, sure. So a lot of that chapter is based on the work of a man named John Cacioppo, who's actually at the University of Chicago, and he studies loneliness. And loneliness, he thinks, is actually inherited in an evolutionary way, and what it does is the point of loneliness is to, when we feel lonely, imagine, you know, whatever, hundreds of thousands of years ago, when we felt lonely, that meant we were on our own and unsafe. So the feeling, the uncomfortable feeling of loneliness, its job was to force us back into our group where we were more safe, because human beings, it turns out, are how we've adapted. We don't have sharp teeth. We can't really run that fast. How we work is by being together in groups. And so we're evolutionarily adapted to cooperate and collaborate and be together, and we feel bad when we're not together. And there's two types of loneliness. One is the type of loneliness, the loneliness for a romantic partner or a best friend, that kind of very intimate loneliness. And that loneliness is characterized in our bodies. We can actually feel it in our bodies differently than the other kind of loneliness. It feels like sadness, right? The other kind of loneliness is loneliness to be part of a group. Not just to be having a heart-to-heart with a friend or a lover, but actually to be in a group talking to many people and having friends, and friends who are friends with each other, so what they call an interconnected friend group. And strangely, we actually feel that kind of loneliness differently in our body. It feels restless. And if we don't satisfy these lonelinesses, if we don't, then we become less happy.
And the science about the interconnected friend group is really interesting. That's really kind of next level happiness.
Right. So an interconnected – let's talk about that for a minute. So it's good to have friends. But actually the science actually tells us exactly how big a friend group we should have and how it should look. And basically, the science tells us that our friend group, our interconnected friend group for us to be optimally happy is about between about 6 and 12 people. If it's more than that, we get overwhelmed with servicing our friendships. If it's less than that, we start to feel unhappy. And the other thing about it is that for us to feel fully satisfied, it has to be interconnected. That is to say that my friends know each other. And the reason for that is that if my friends are if my friend group is interconnected, then let's suppose I do something nice for John. Because John knows Mary, when I do something nice for John, Mary hears about it and knows I'm a good player. And then when I need something, I don't have to turn to John, who I did something good for last time, but I can just as well turn to Mary because Mary knows that I'm the type of person that serves my friends. So that's one of the reasons why interconnection actually works, that we can build what's called social capital in an interconnected group.
You know, it's interesting to think about where interconnected friends are more likely to happen. I think most people would say, well, a city where there's lots of people in a close space would be easier than the suburbs, which would be probably easier than living in a rural community, although, I mean, there might be institutions in the rural community that do that for people, or maybe a dependence thing that does that for people. But it seems almost like most of us are set up to not have that.
Well, if you think about it, our economy, the root of the purpose of our economy is not for all of us to make friends. In fact, if you look at a standard advertisement, there's an advertisement that I'm fond of talking about where it's for a kind of a car, and basically a dad is with his two kids, and as the story goes, the backstory for most of us who are dads is that we hardly ever spend enough time with our kids, and he and his two kids, they have a toy remote control car, and it breaks. So in other words, the dad is letting his kids down yet again. That's the implied story. And so the dad gets in his real car and puts the broken remote control car next to him, and the kid is like moving the remote control, and he watches the broken car and drives his car around, and his kid's like so happy that he throws away his teddy bear because his dad's being so great. I'm laughing because it's so ridiculous. Yep. The theme of this advertisement is if you get the right car, you'll be a good dad. Yeah. As opposed to just being a good dad. Now, most of us, many of us have so many pressures on us that it's really hard to be a good dad. And it's really hard to be friends that we want to be friends. It's hard to gather together friend groups. And that's because our entire economy is not about creating a community, which is what makes people happy, but about getting and buying more stuff. That's the whole myth that we have. So we actually have to work against that. We actually have to – and the reason why this talk about friend groups and gathering our people is in How to Be Alive is that, one, it's actually the thing that makes us happier to have and be part of community, makes us happier than to work for and get more stuff and use our time getting more stuff. And two, because if we find the right people, that is to say, if we find the people who embrace the types of values that we want to work towards in our lives, like if we're feeling like we want to be more of service or we want to be more creative, then finding and being part of a friend group that also embraces those values of creativity or of service to the world is a way to help us move towards that too.
Your friend group amps up cooperation rather than competition. And we're always told, you know, we're supposed to be competitive and beat the other guy. But that's not really what our happiness wants.
Right. It's not what we were evolved to do. We were – the way that human beings, before they lived in urban environments, survived was by cooperation with each other.
How does this apply to real life? You call the folks in your – book Life Questers, and can you give us some example of people who've taken you up on these kind of things or who are doing this and what their results are?
Sure. I mean, I can tell you in particular about people who I feature in my book who I felt so proud to know that I put them in the book because I felt they were life questers. And one, so to be a life quester, We talked earlier about how the societal myth is falling apart, but there is no new myth. That is to say that our society has not laid down new paths for people who see that the old myth is falling apart. And so the only thing that's left is that we actually refer deeply to ourselves and our values and our bodies and ask ourselves what is right for me. That's back to the giving more energy to what's true for me, giving less energy to what's not true for me. And so what I call the people who have the bravery to decide to reject the standard life approach and to take their own approach is a life quester, because they're questing for a way of life. And I think of them as bushwhackers. That is to say, a bushwhacker is somebody who takes a machete and goes through the jungle, and they're chopping the plants down as they move through the jungle. Not that I'm in favor of chopping plants, but whatever. They move through the jungle, and it leaves a path for everybody else. So a life quester is doing service for their own lives, but they're also laying down a path for others. And shall I tell you a couple of stories of life questers?
Yep. Let's hear them.
Okay. So one is my friend Kate Zidar, and she did the whole standard thing, and she went to school for microbiology, and she found herself in a lab where she was literally dissecting dead mice, taking their brains out and liquefying them and putting them on slides. That was her job. And she was like, I just can't do this. And it was boring. It didn't feel right to her. So she quit. And she ended up volunteering at a community garden. And one of the problems, this was in Williamsburg in Brooklyn. And one of the problems was that the soil there was bad because of the lead content in the air from pollution that had, settled into the soil. And so the soil needed to be remediated. And so one way to bring health back to soil is to put compost in it. And so she started a compost pile in one of the parks. And what she did was she took a few barrels and she put cinder blocks down inside the barrels so that they couldn't be easily moved by the park people. And she put them in a corner where the park people didn't care that much. And then she wrote to the mayor and asked permission to put these barrels there for food scraps to be put in. The mayor never wrote back, but whenever a park official challenged her in her composting in the park, she would show this letter that she wrote and say that she had permission from the mayor. And she ended up starting this whole community of composters, right? And you think, oh, why does that matter? A bunch of people are dropping off their food scraps and they're being composted and put in the community garden, except that here in New York, many people were doing something like that they were starting compost piles for people. And it's just a few years ago now that New York, the city itself, adopted curbside composting. And part of the reason why they adopted the curbside composting was because these compost piles were popping up all over the place. So that's one life quester.
I wanted to ask you a bit about your philosophy, religious philosophy, too, before we go. And you're a Zen practitioner. You're a Zen teacher. And how does your philosophy about faith, does faith fit into this in some way?
Well, I like to say that I don't really have a philosophy per se, that actually, and I think this is true, I happen to practice with the Zen folks. I'm not that fond of saying that that I'm a Buddhist or something like that, because I think that actually defining ourselves by who we practice our religions with can be divisive. And I think that there are many paths up the mountain. But what I in the Zen tradition, in all the traditions, ultimately what's pointed to is a certain mystery, a certain that actually all of us come from this place of not knowing, that we don't know what will happen when we die. I mean, we do get told stories about what will happen. We don't know where we were before we were born, if we were anywhere before we were born. In fact, many of us don't even know, leave aside the where we were before we were born and where we'll go when we die. We're kind of understanding what's going on right now is pretty confusing. And so this the tradition in which I study, and Zen is the mystical tradition of Buddhism, just as mysticism is the mystical tradition of Christianity, and Kabbalah is the mystical tradition of Judaism, and Sufism is the mystical tradition of Islam. All of these traditions point to a place before the scriptures and the dogma that is taught, just directly back to this mystery and this place of not knowing. And the basic idea is that we work so hard to move away from the mystery, but there is relief in just returning to it. And when we return to the mystery and stop navigating our lives by these stories of what will get us what we want and what will help us avoid what we don't want, but actually just pay attention to what's happening. To your article of faith, the article of faith is that if we really just pay attention and just have the humility to be here in this moment, then correct actions will arise. We'll automatically act with love and compassion for ourselves and for our neighbors and for the world that we live in.
Colin Bevin is the author of How to Be Alive, A Kind of Happiness That Helps the World. Thanks a lot for joining us and talking with us about how to be alive.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up after the break, we'll have Monica Eng and Food Mondays, and we'll talk about pickling waste. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. According to the Natural Resources Defense Council, about 40% of American food goes to waste. And a big reason that happens is produce spoilage. One company in Chicago called Hazel Technologies has been working on a tool to slow that spoilage. And they estimate that just this year, they've prevented 20,000 tons of CO2 equivalents from being injected into the atmosphere. Worldview food contributor Monica Eng recently talked to the company's CEO and co-founder, biochemist Aidan Mowat, and she started by asking him how his company began.
We came out in about 2015. We formed the company. The idea being that we could use highly sustainable and very clever biochemistry to preserve the shelf life of produce and reduce food waste that comes from spoilage during the storage and transit processes. So my background is in chemistry, and myself and one of the other co-founders, Adam Pressler, invented a new kind of technology that allows us to control small molecule signaling in produce that is still alive and breathing. And in doing so, we can actually slow down the aging process as well as fight mold, fungus, and other diseases that limit shelf life.
And with so much food waste out there because of food deteriorating, this could be a real game changer. How did you guys come to this idea?
Well, the genesis for me, I think, was pretty unique. I was a member of the Institute for Sustainability and Energy at Northwestern during my PhD. And in the process of that fellowship, I was put in a number of courses that exposed me to the challenges in sustainability in major world systems. So I looked at it and you think, okay, well, revolutions in clean energy have caused the price of clean energy to drop, particularly solar, to drop precipitously over the last 20 or 30 years. We have cheap wind. We have cheap geothermal. Transportation, we have electric vehicles. But agriculture, which I view as fundamentally dependent on chemical inputs, really hasn't seen quite the same kind of revolution. It's still a fairly slow-moving, conservative, and chemical-heavy industry. So as a chemist, I thought this is an area where I can actually positively contribute. We can leverage smarter chemistry to reduce the amount of chemical inputs that go into our food. And in our case, designing atmospheric controls for chemistry, we can actually not add any chemicals at all into the food supply chain while extending shelf life for consumers. So it was a real intersection of what I viewed as a major world problem. You know, on the other side of that is an opportunity and my own particular expertise and the ability to interact with that problem.
Okay. So just how effective and powerful is this technology and what does it look like physically?
That's a great question because when you tell people you're going to be treating the atmosphere of their produce, you know, it's not something you can see or at least it shouldn't be something you can see or smell or taste. So in terms of what we can accomplish in produce, you know, we typically see shelf life extensions that are on the order of two or threefold the standard shelf life of that given crop. And it's a difficult question because not every crop has the same kind of longevity to begin with. So if you're talking about extending the shelf life of a banana, a threefold shelf life extension might be another 3 weeks. Whereas a tomato, it might be another 3 months, depending on the state of picking. And there's a few other things in there as well. We're able to preserve the nutritional quality of the produce during the storage and transit process, or we enable growers to pick food at a riper state than they otherwise would in order for travel. So that actually improves the consumer experience in terms of having higher quality and better tasting produce. And the way that we do that is we manufacture active packaging inserts. So the best example I can give is something that we like to call the in-box sachet. Sachet looks a little bit like a sugar packet or one of those desiccant packets that you would find in a bag of beef jerky or a box of shoes. It's about 2.5 centimeters by 2.5 centimeters, weighs about 0.25 gram, and is capable of treating up to about a 50-pound box of produce. So very small footprint, very large impact. And what that does is a grower or a packer will throw that into the box when they're packing up the produce for distribution to retailers. The packet can store and time release an active ingredient into the atmosphere of the produce during the storage and transit process. So to talk about sort of the invisible chemistry that's going on, we typically use an ethylene inhibitor for these kinds of things.
And ethylene is the gas that comes off of ripe fruit. When people say, hey, these mangoes aren't ripe, well, put it in a bag with a ripe banana, and that ripe banana is going to be releasing ethylene that'll help other things ripen more. And so if you inhibit that ethylene, you're going to slow the ripening process?
Yeah, look at that. You're already a biochemist. No, that's exactly correct. Ethylene is an aging hormone that is a gas that's emitted by produce during the aging process, and it triggers a lot of responses that initially are about ripening but then ultimately become about over-ripening and then decay. Our ethylene inhibitors, when they're present in the atmosphere in very, very small concentrations, they actually shut down the produce's response to that ethylene signal. And so as a result, we can lower the metabolism of the produce, essentially putting it to sleep while it travels. And then that allows the produce to arrive in better quality than it otherwise would.
And we know that when people pick, let's say, peaches in California, they need to pick them in a not super ripe state because they're going to be traveling across country and you don't want them, you know, jumping around and getting squashed. Same with tomatoes. Tomatoes are generally picked like hard tennis balls. Will this change things for those crops?
Yeah, you know, you pick two really great examples of where commercial agriculture has failed to live up to its own, you know, economic process. Peaches, the American peach industry in particular, is in very dire shape for a series of reasons, most of which are related to this intersection between what the growers have to do in order to get the peach to the store in edible shape versus what we like to call the Brix content, the sugar content of the peach. So you like a peach when it has high Brix content. That means it's a nice sweet peach. It tastes delicious. But there's an inverse relationship between the amount of time it spends on the tree and the amount of sugars that it contains. So you have growers that are picking stuff. It's nice and hard and firm, and it passes the drop test. You can move it through the supply chain without destroying the fruit. But by the time it actually ripens at the consumer side, there was no sugar in that peach to begin with. It's a bit like eating a piece of cardboard. Mm-hmm. And then conversely, if you look at, you know, a great example is the peaches they grow down in Carbondale, Illinois. Everybody in the area will swear it's the best peach you'll ever have, and they're very, very high sugar, but because of that, they're also very soft and very susceptible to decay, so they don't travel. So that's precisely the problem that we developed this technology to fix. You know, spoilage is what causes a lot of this food waste in the distribution system to begin with. So you always have to keep an eye out for the big boogeyman, which is stuff going bad. But the consequences of commercial agriculture, which cause us to have less flavorful and less nutritious food, those are also challenges that we can overcome. And we can do that by providing the grower with the same quality of robustness during storage and transit while still allowing them to pull fruit off the vine or off the tree in a better state for the consumer. And if you have that combination of quality and shelf life, then you've got the horse as well as the cart. That's how we look at it.
And so you guys have been doing a lot of tests in your lab, and that's near Illinois Institute of Technology. You're basically on the campus. Tell me about some of those tests.
Sure, sure. So we have an active post-harvest science group, which is a branch of plant physiology that is studied in universities all over the world. And many great extension and co-op programs, and many of whom we're actually partnered with, folks like UC Davis, Oregon State University, Washington State, University of Florida, and so forth. And a lot of it comes down to, you know, measuring the interaction between various storage parameters and actual metrical quality. So, you know, I think probably the average consumer doesn't think about quality being something that you can quantify, but there are many ways to do so. One example being firmness. You look at the amount of pressure it takes to penetrate a certain depth into the flesh of a piece of produce, and you can create an empirical measure of the amount of firmness in that fruit. So it's a very intricate series of things where you have to pay attention to what the consumer wants as well as what the grower wants as well as what the retailer wants. And that's kind of where we position ourselves on the scientific side.
And one of the things you've been testing are black figs. And so you brought me some pickled black figs because I guess you had a bunch left over?
Mm-hmm. Yep. We work with a great farm in California called Vertical Foods. It's one of the largest fig producers in California. And full disclosure, the wife of the owner is one of my senior sales managers. So there's a deep industry connection that you can tell they believe in the product. You know what I mean? So they sent us was essentially a pallet of black figs. We perform our studies, but then at the end of the day, somebody has to do something with the produce. So sometimes we donate it. Sometimes we just divvy it up amongst the various companies that are at the office park where we're at. But I've been interested in the culinary arts for quite some time and got into pickling and fermentation and various other ways of preserving produce, even creating alcohol, believe it or not, as a preservative technique, right? At the end of the day, that's how you preserve the caloric content of something in a way that doesn't go bad anymore because the alcohol is a preservative. So I am a big fan of using natural processes to keep stuff from going bad. If you ever want to figure out how to lacto-ferment figs, it's very quite simple. Just submerge them in a 3.5% brine for somewhere between 3 and 7 days, depending on how many wild yeasts you've got present. And watch out for the amount of carbonation that it generates because that will create a big mess if you seal it up too early.
Right. You do not want any explosions.
No. In fact, you're probably going to want to vent that when you get it home just to be on the safe side. I think it's fine, but I don't want to give you a bomb. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Now, I've seen a lot of sci-fi movies, and in those, there are always unintended consequences. Are you guys looking out for them? How so? And what might these be?
Yeah, I mean, that's an incredibly important aspect of trying to put any chemistry into the supply chain. One of the reasons that I say that chemistry is fundamental to agriculture is that in general speaking, there's about a 50% chance that you and I are alive because of a single chemical process that was invented in the very late 19th century, early 20th century by Fritz Haber called the Haber-Bosch process. And it's how we convert nitrogen into ammonia for a nitrogen source in fertilizer. And that was how we fed the world. That's how we got to the population that we have on the planet today. So you want to talk about unintended
consequences. The Green Revolution planting row to row.
Precisely, yeah. So in terms of unintended consequences, you know, it's projected that the world population would only be about 3.5 billion today if that process hadn't been put into commercial production. So, you know, there's always a realm where you have to be concerned about that sort of thing. Now, for us, we're a little bit different. And the reason that we're different is that we're not actually an active ingredient synthesis company. So we're not out there preparing new chemistries. I think there are a lot of apparatuses to help those companies move along. You see a lot of work from the EPA, a lot of toxicology testing, a lot of human health analysis and environmental health analysis. Sometimes things slip through the cracks even. You're talking about things like chlorpyrifos or neonicotinoids.
That's a pesticide that's not good, especially for pollinators.
Mm-hmm, exactly, yeah. So there's always concerns there, but we've selected the actives that we work with that are public domain actives based on their toxicology history, based on the fact that they have no incidence in human, animal, plant, or aquatic environments in a 30 or so year of commercial deployment all across the world. We know a lot about the chemistry of the compounds that we work with. They're what we call bioorthogonal, meaning that there's no uptake pathway in human metabolism.
Okay. And so, you know, for the consumer, when might a consumer, you know, be eating a tomato that was transported with the aid of your product?
Well, we've been working with a number of growers on a preliminary basis in the U.S. for some time now. And in addition to the fact that we've been working heavily in Latin America, which is a large export program to the United States. So with a number of different crop categories, you know, if you've been eating apples this year, there's a good chance that you've had apples that have been treated with our product. Same thing with pears over the last couple of years. We're very heavy in stone fruit, in particular in California. And so everything from apricots to nectarines to peaches and plums, many producers are actually using our product, and it's been making its way to the retail store over the last couple of years. You've got a number of tropicals. We are partnered with the largest avocado grower in the world, Mission Avocado. We also work with a number of the largest tropicals growers to do things like star fruit and passion fruit and dragon fruit and things like that, which has been a very successful program for us because of the difficulties in the tropical supply chain coming to the U.S. So, you know, I'd say there's an outside chance that a lot of the listeners have actually already eaten things that have been treated with our product.
And what about for the consumer? I've got a boatload of tomatoes right now that are coming in my garden in this late summer. Might there be an opportunity at some point for me to like stick them in my basement with a little sachet on top of a bushel?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's actually something we're really excited about. We have this very modular system with a very small footprint that can make its way into essentially any component of the agricultural supply chain. So, you know, it gives us the opportunity to work with smallholder farmers and with local rooftop growers and things like that. But ultimately, it's completely safe to use and deploy in consumer context as well. And so we're going through the approval steps required to generate those products. But I do believe that you will see a consumer-oriented approach perhaps as early as about this time next year, to be honest. So keep an eye out.
Do you have any estimates on how many zillion pounds of fruit you've saved from going bad so far?
As a matter of fact, I do. I don't know about zillion pounds. That would be that'd be remarkable. Yeah, we've only been around for 4.5 years, so we're going to walk before we run. But even so, over the last 2 or 3 years, I estimate that we've saved somewhere around 200 million pounds of produce from going bad already. Which is something that I'm quite proud of. This year alone, I think we'll be offsetting 120 million pounds of produce from going bad. It's about 20,000 tons of CO2 equivalents we're saving from being injected into the atmosphere. And all of that is a relatively small scale. I mean, that's the thing about agriculture is it's a massive, massive industry. It's the biggest industry in the world. So we're scaling up into it, and that's part of what we're here to do.
Aidan Mowat, co-founder and CEO of Hazel Technologies, thanks so much for talking to me today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
You're the cutest thing that I ever did see. I really love your beaches, wanna shake your tree. Lovey-dovey, lovey-dovey, lovey-dovey all the time.
Peaches, tomatoes, everything is better if it's better preserved, isn't it there? Monica Eng, our food contributor, is here with me in the studio, and we've got a few of Aidan's figs with us. You brought his figs.
That's right. So he doesn't just preserve things through this new technology, but when they're about to go off, he turns them into pickles and liquor. He said, watch out, because these might contain about a third of a shot of alcohol at this point. And we're Facebook Living it if anybody wants to see us eat this on my Facebook account. So you want to give it a try?
Yes, I do. It smells. We can smell it. It smells like wine.
This
does not
does.
Smell like a straight fig or anything.
Yeah. Okay. So Jerome tries it. What do you think?
Hey, not bad.
Wow.
A lot of flavor.
Oh, when he said pickled, he mean pickled.
This it was is pickled. Isn't that like a fig?
I thought it's salty. It's got a brine, and you know, I'm doing some pickling myself. I took a bunch of beans from my garden, put them again in a brine, and it makes it taste like there's vinegar in there, and it develops through lactofermentation. And it's a great way to preserve stuff this time of year if you don't want it to go off. If your garden, I understand you have a lot of tomatoes in your garden too, Jerome?
I sure did. I think I had to throw one out this morning.
Oh, boy. When I lived in the former Soviet Union, everybody on their porch, on their little balcony of their place in their massif would have, which are these big public housing complexes, would have these big things of pickled tomatoes that you would have with your vodka. And they were doing lacto-fermentation before it got cool with the hipsters here in the United States.
So someday we'll be able to buy little packets that extend our garden's produce from this guy.
Absolutely. And he said, watch out for a big announcement. He was kind of hinting that's going to happen that will bring this technology to more people. And I think that the fewer things we throw in the landfill to produce greenhouse gases and the fewer things we throw away, the better. So I'm kind of excited about this technology.
Is it better? I mean, our tomatoes, we can put them in the freezer if we catch them and things. There's other things you can do.
We can do.
He's kind of up against some other things.
Yeah, but this would be at the sort of the shipping end. But Jerome, I wanted to come on my last Food Monday to toast you, to toast
Thanks.
Worldview, to toast food and sustainability coverage with a pickled fig. And you know, it makes me think of Slivovica, which is that Czech Slovak liquor. And it makes me think of Miloš. And I want to toast Miloš and say thank you so much for having me on Worldview.
You're welcome. It's been so fun. And I've learned so much. I'm so into like all these grains and stuff. It's been great.
Yeah, and I just rode my bike here because you turned me into a bike rider. So thank you.
I think we're creating a community of people who want to do things better.
That's right, like not get packaging when they get their takeout.
Absolutely. Monica Eng, our food contributor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Worldview, we are going to start talking about Gandhi's 150th birthday. It's Wednesday. We will talk with Vijay Prashad tomorrow, and we'll discuss some of the real heroic aspects of Gandhi and some of the myth-making that's been going on around him. And we will recall his achievements tomorrow on Worldview. Hope you can join us. You can follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Radio Worldview. And Worldview is produced by Steve Bynum, Julian Haida, and Ashish Valentine. Thanks to Mike Gilmore for engineering. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and you've been listening to Worldview on WBEZ.